This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed, healthy food that actually tastes good. Visit bobsredmill.com today and use the code TASTEPOD, TASTEPOD, all one word, for 25% off your order.
I'm HRN Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're focusing on water. You'll hear some disturbing news from an NYC investigative reporter.
Here lies the problem, how much we don't know about water tanks.
Katie Kiefer reports on water woes in the heartland.
Their water is heavily polluted with nitrates, which are coming from agricultural chemical applications on fields and running off into their water table.
And we'll check in with Dave Arnold, who's about to open a new bar that will serve some pretty fancy H2O.
It is hardcore.
So pour up a tall glass of ice water and be refreshed by this week's episode of Meat in 3, available on heritageradionetwork.org, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And you all know the phrase, the old adage, power of the press. Well, the power of the press is never truer than when it comes to restaurant reviews. A good review can make a business, a bad review can break it. But when did all this start? When were these restaurant critics so heralded that people rushed to get them hot off the press and read the news? Well, Grimaud de la Reynière is credited with being the first restaurant reviewer and critic, and that was in the early 1800s, about 1803. He really originated sort of the double genre of food critic and restaurant guide. And there were a lot of restaurant guides to tell you where to go and eat, but not really an objective review. Later on, in the early 1800s, Le Reynière, he sort of established the idea that the consuming public really wanted guidance from an authoritative judge. And that played out for quite a few years. In fact, a century and a half. Soon after, Delmonico's opened in 1835, the first fine dining restaurant in the United States, actually in New York City, for sure. And before you knew it, there were restaurant reviewers popping up with as many new restaurants that popped up. My guest today knows a thing or two about restaurant reviews and the power of the press. Mimi Sheraton was the New York Times food reviewer from 1976 to 1983. And before that, she was a pioneering food writer and a former restaurant critic at the Village Voice and wrote for Condé Nast Traveler. And when she left the Times in 83, Mimi went on to serve as food critic and reporter for Time magazine and spent 3 weeks in China doing a major food event. She also traveled for Condé Nast Traveler around the world and flew business class, as she said. Her writing on food and travel has appeared in such magazines as The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Smithsonian, Vogue, Town and Country, New York, Food and Wine. The list goes on. You name it, she's been published in those. Her reviews and articles have been published that. She has written 16 books, including The German Cookbook, which was written in 1965 and has never been out of print. That's pretty remarkable right there. And a memoir, Eating My Words, An Appetite for Life. She has won James Beard Awards, IACP Awards for her books. And her most recent book is 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, which is a must read. We'll talk more about that later. But as Harold McGee said, on every page I learned something new. Mimi has taken cooking courses at the China Institute in New York, at Le Cordon Bleu in Paris, and studied with private teachers in Copenhagen, Beirut, Phnom Penh, and Istanbul. And her articles have been published, as I mentioned, all over the place. She's lectured on food criticism, which is what we're going to talk about today, at Cornell's Hotel and Restaurant School and at the Culinary Institute of America's California campus. Mimi is a regular contributor to the Daily Beast, and I don't think she would mind my telling that Mimi is 92 years old. She's a regular contributor to the Daily Beast, and not to be outdone, she's keeping up with the times, and she is now a podcaster. She has a new podcast called, with Dan Pashman of Sporkful, called Ask Mimi. Mimi Sheridan, it is my pleasure to welcome you here today. You are putting many of us to shame, I have to say.
Well, thank you, Linda, but listening to you go through all of my background made me feel very old because I've had so much time to do so many things. But I've been very, very fortunate because food has given me a great life with great people and great travels. And I think that's the bonus in a field such as ours.
Well, you are very gracious about that. You can take us through. I mean, we know that the New York Times is the heralded, you know, pinnacle of review for a restaurant. There are a lot of competitors out there today. And of course, when we think of other restaurant viewers around the country, you know, you think of Jonathan Gold in LA, Irene Verbilla, who was there for many years, Michael Bauer out in San Francisco, the late Bill Rice in Chicago. All of these names, it's, you know, people in the food world, I think, know the names of the restaurant reviewers more so than they do the names of some of the lead reporters for
the
news.
Well, I think they follow it so avidly now. And, of course, it's been watered down a great deal now about all of the other consumer reviews that come across. Yelp, Zagat, all of that has more or less cushioned the criticisms of the professional critics, I think.
And yet I think people who do a critical read of reviews, you know, still go for somebody who has made that their profession. Tell me a little bit, take us a little bit through when it first started in the New York Times, for instance, because that's your background.
Well, it started in the New York Times by Craig Claiborne, whose shoulders we all stand on, I really must say. He was very professional. He knew exactly what he was talking about. And he got really permission from the Times to do small, they were very small reviews every Friday. I think he was Friday. I was Friday. I don't know.
Friday was the day for many, many years.
In the weekend section, not in the food section, right, which is where I think it belongs anyway, but that's another story. I would have yelled like mad if they put mine in the food section on Wednesday. But Craig had a great deal of authority. He was very well trained. He had been to the hotel and restaurant school in Lucerne. He knew all about the cooking. And he had been working on Gourmet Magazine, I believe, in Chicago, and then came to New York. And they instituted the review. Now, there were some then. Gourmet Magazine, from its inception, had restaurant reviews, but always, always positive. And in those days, if you wanted to call the reviewer, you were connected to the advertising department because it was the restaurants that advertised that got the reviews. But Craig turned it around. He tried very hard and was very successful at being anonymous and not being recognized. He was fortunate in a way that he looked rather bland and fitting in. I don't mean that as not a compliment. He was very dapper and well-dressed, but he didn't stand out in that way. So he maintained anonymity, as I did, for many years until finally it became very difficult, but I never, like Craig, I never made a reservation in my own name.
But you were one of the first to actually use disguises, right?
Yeah, I used wigs and glasses, not clothes, but I had three different wigs, and I had a friend whose family was in the eyeglass frame business, so I had about six pairs, of course, with clear glass, because I didn't wear glasses, but different frames, and I would put it on, the wig and so on, in the cab going to the restaurant. I wouldn't even do it in the New York Times office because I didn't want anybody to know what they looked like. Of course, eventually, many restaurateurs began to catch on, and there was nothing quite as embarrassing as to come in with a wig and have them say, "Good evening, Miss Sheraton." You don't know whether...
Cover is blown.
Yeah, but the reviews got longer and longer, and eventually became two every week. When I started, I had to do two every Friday. And the Times, I think, still maintains the wonderful requirement that you go at least three times.
And that's excellent.
And I could go many more, and often did, if it was complicated and inconsistent.
Right. Now, Craig started this, it was the late 50s, right? About 57.
Yeah, I would say that it was about 57, 58. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was doing a lot of consulting to restaurant associates on the opening of the Four Seasons, and I remember everybody in their office talking about this new critic at the Times and what will he mean when he comes to our restaurants.
And so, did you ever know that you'd be taking that place?
I certainly wanted to, and when he left, there were three critics between Craig and me, and when he left, it became known that they wanted a man to replace him. They didn't interview any women, and several executives at the time speaking to restaurateurs said, "Oh, we want a man," including the woman who was the editor of that section and was a big feminist, and there were three men between Craig and me. And by that time, I had been writing for New York Magazine a couple of years, and the editor, Joan Whitman, called me and said, "We have an opening. We'd like you to come over." But it wasn't for the critic at the time. They said, "When John Cannaday leaves, you will have the job." Mm. So I wrote about food. It was about 6 months, and I was there until 1984. So from 76 to 84, I was the critic.
Yeah, you think of it, that there were, I mean, well, Irene Verbilla, she was writing in L.A.
In L.A.
early on, but there are very few lead.
Phyllis Richmond.
Ah, Phyllis Richmond,
at the Washington Post.
Right.
And, of course, Gail Green was already at New York Magazine by the time I got to the Times.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Irene was already there, but I do remember Phyllis Richmond was one of the earliest.
Well, it's said that Craig Claiborne single-handedly created the vocabulary of food criticism and the four-star rating system.
Yes. I'm not sure about vocabulary, but certainly the parameters and the little box that, you know, what does the rating mean and so on. I added to that by adding recommended dishes,
yes,
which are now
excellent
in the box.
That's right.
But I added that to it because people really like to be told if they're... See, I wrote not for the food world. I wrote for the in my mind, for the people who came in, the Bridge and Tunnel crowd who came in on a Saturday night to celebrate someone. That's who I really wanted to be able to get what I meant. The food people will understand and they'll read it. But I tried to make the unusual experience as familiar as possible because it can be awkward to walk into a fancy restaurant like Le Cirque on a Saturday night to celebrate your birthday.
And not know what to expect, right?
Yeah, and I wanted them to know what to expect.
Well, you followed that very well. I mean, I was an avid follower, I know. I rushed to the Times every Friday to read those reviews. And along with Craig, you continued that, and Gail Green as well, building that foundation of professionalism, which I think was, as you mentioned, it's so important. And then it's been said that you and Gail Green, he formed the foundation, and you and Gail kind of gussied it up a bit. Now, I don't know what...
She gussied more than I did. She was very gussy, and she had an audience for
she
it.
Did,
I mean,
she was
very successful. I did a much cooler kind of thing. I didn't gussy it up.
Well, in that, in the foundation of professionalism, what do you feel you just described that you wanted those people to get it. You didn't want them to walk into an unknown situation. What do you feel is the role or the responsibility of a quality restaurant reviewer?
Well, I think to do what we were talking about, to tell the reader what to expect, to guide the reader to the good dishes, to try to warn them off the bad dishes, to describe the surroundings, more for women who always want to know, what shall I wear?
Right.
It's a little less important now because everybody wears any old thing or any fancy thing to any place. What the service will be like, and if there's anything peculiar about the facilities, you maybe want to tell them that. I think the Times does that very well now with wheelchair access, mm-hmm. and bathroom access. Mm-hmm. And you want to be very candid about what you like and what you don't like.
And there's also the price point range. You
always
give that.
Well, what the text says in the Times, it still says the reviewer's evaluation in relation to price. In other words, at a certain low price, you might forgive a few lapses, but mm-hmm. at a very high price, you forgive nothing.
You better expect the
but
works.
But you made that very clear. I tried to make it very, very clear where the value was. It was a question of value.
I have a question about that because we talked about Craig and you building up that star system. Of course, the Michelin Guide always gave stars.
That's the model. That was obviously the model. Anonymous guides going in and giving stars. Now, there are reviewers who feel they do not like to give a rating. But I thought about it for a long time, but I thought the star rating was a very good thing for me to decide how I really came down on a place. And it was very good for restaurants in promoting it, and the public loved it. So altogether, it made it a good idea to have stars.
And I mentioned the Guide Michelin. They never reviewed American restaurants until just several years ago, recently.
Right.
But it was only European. First, it was only French, and then it was.
They're only
European.
Useful in France.
Yeah.
I feel.
Huh.
I feel the Guide Michelin in Italy can be a disaster.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And
yeah.
then there's Gomio, that came
right,
about as well.
Right.
But again, for American restaurants, American reviewers, I think the newspapers initially, those newspaper food critics were the word.
Well, I think they're still the most powerful for an immediate reaction. I mean, if you're a national magazine such as Gourmet used to be, they did restaurant criticism. But as Andre Soltner of Lutèce told me once, the impact from New York Times and to a slightly lesser extent New York Magazine is immediate. But Gourmet can go on for years. Someone can come in who read about you in Gourmet a year and a half ago, and this is the first time they've come to New York, and so it had a longer lasting impact.
That's true. And I always think of Gourmet as being more of an international travel guide restaurant.
Yeah, but they had very serious, for a while it was Jonathan Gold under Ruth Reichel and so on.
Yeah. And the star rating, I'd like to talk about how you've seen restaurants change, and can the same star system apply, let's say, to you want to go to a very popular restaurant, but it's more of a joint. And can the same star system apply to that?
Yeah. How well does it do what it is supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
I gave 4 stars to Hatsuhana when it opened up in New York. And the French and Italian restaurateurs went crazy. How could she give 4 stars to a Japanese? Not even one of us, you know.
Well, and that was a thing. I mean,
it was perfect. It looked perfect.
It was beautiful.
And serious Japanese people I know here still go to Hatsuhana for the real McCoy. You know, no fooling.
Yeah.
But I gave 4 stars to Vienna 79, and that was an Austrian restaurant. And again, and the French weren't really so sure that the Italians would deserve it. They thought only a French restaurant could get 4 stars. Fortunately, that is no longer true. You have to be very good at what you say you are.
Interesting. Yeah, because back in the day, fine dining was synonymous with French cuisine.
That's right. Even if the people were Swiss or German or Italian, I mean, a chef would adopt a French name. Now, of course, one of the great, I think, results of the mid 70s and so on were the respect for American chefs. And higher quality people going in for it and being professional. I mean, Dan Rose of Le Coucou made his name in Paris. That's at a right. restaurant yeah. called Spring. An American in Paris making a reputation for a restaurant.
Unheard of, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really something. Now, you mentioned that the importance of anonymity. Tell us why was it so important to remain anonymous?
Because you don't want special service and you don't want special preparation of food. And I once wrote an article for Vanity Fair on what a restaurateur could do when he knew the critic. Because people used to say, well, if you come in unannounced and you're suddenly there, what can they do? They can do a lot. And I went through, you know, how they seat you, how they talk to you. They may redo your steak if you ordered it rare and it came out a little too well done. I wrote this whole article, and then I had a call from Adi Giovanetti, a very fine restaurateur who had the restaurant Il Nido, among others. And he said, Signora, you don't know the half of it. We can do much more than that. If you order an appetizer, we have plenty of time to play with your main course. And there are many critics who say it's not important, because they can't afford to pay. They work for publications that don't pay and accept free meals. And now I don't think there's a newspaper around that would allow that to happen.
Well, that's something interesting to mention, that you paid your check. I mean, you were reimbursed by the newspaper.
Of course.
But you were not allowed to accept any
nothing.
Freebies.
I was once at a restaurant in Shanyi, La Meloise, I think it was called, in Shanyi. And somehow they knew, I know how they knew, but they did know that I was there. And we were four people, and they said, there's no check. And we said, we have to have a check, and no check. And finally, we left a pile of cash. All four of us put our money. We didn't want to use a credit card because they could just not put it in.
Right.
You know, so we left this big pile of cash in the center of the table and left.
Oh, but that's really...
It was a good,
a good
restaurant.
Story.
They made wonderful œuf à la marée, which is something I love. Eggs poached in red wine.
What major changes have you seen over the years in restaurants?
Well, certainly in less formality. Certainly in a lot of new restaurants that don't take reservations, certainly in crowded rooms, certainly in noise. And another thing Andre Sultna pointed out to me, many restaurateurs now want their initial money back in a much shorter time than the older used to. I don't remember the exact number, but for example, let's say we expected our money back in 10 years. Now they want their money back in 3 years.
Wow.
So there's a big initial push to do something major in the way of publicity so that people come right away, and many fold. I mean, they come and go. You know, if a new restaurant opens in a place, you can usually mean that an old restaurant closed in that place.
That's right.
But there's now an unpleasant change in New York, especially in my neighborhood, maybe yours too. I live in the West Village, and many of what I consider pleasantly serviceable restaurants, very nice food, not dirt cheap, but moderately priced, where you might go two or three times a week if you lived there and didn't feel like cooking, those are closing because they do not cook at a level that would justify the new price they have to charge, not only rent, but they have to pay all of the reservation services,
right.
Yelp, Open Table,
right.
Resy, and it's become so important on all sides to have food delivery that this one restaurant around the corner from me had to employ three messenger boys and pay fringe benefits, full salary, and it was just getting to the point where he would have to change his cooking to meet the price he would have to have, and though he could do it, he was close to 60 years old and didn't feel like changing his model, so he closed it and went off and did consulting in the business. And it's happening all around. I'm beginning to take it personally. And the final blow was the announced closing of Lord & Taylor, which restaurant. But I live downtown, as you do, and that was the nearest for me. Great department store.
Yeah.
It was lovely. There was never anybody in it.
Times are changing. Rents are definitely having
well,
an impact.
Well, also life is changing.
Yes.
Online ordering of things has caused the demise of many retail. You know, you figure, oh, yeah, I really want to support the store, but what the heck? One minute Amazon has it at my door. And
we don't have to leave our apartments.
We can
sit at home.
I often don't.
We're going to talk more about the changes in restaurant reviewing and the effects that has on diners when we come back after a short break. So keep those thoughts and stay with us.
I'll do that.
I recently interviewed historian Ken Albala to talk about the history of noodles. And I was interested to learn that some of the oldest noodles that there's evidence of were made with millet. Now, that's an interesting grain that we wouldn't think of to make noodles with, but it got me thinking about one of my other favorite noodles, and that's pizzoccheri. Pizzoccheri are made, they're a thick, dense noodle made with buckwheat. And at bobsredmill.com, you can get everything you need to make these unusual types of noodles and pastas. For the pizzoccheri, you would add about 1 cup of buckwheat flour and 2 cups of regular flour, and then follow your regular pasta recipe. The noodles are thick, dense, usually served with cabbage or potatoes. It's a recipe from the Valtellina section of Italy. And again, Bob's Red Mill will supply you with everything you need. That's bobsredmill.com. And don't forget to add TastePod, TastePod, for 25% off your order. Hi, we're back, and sitting here in the studio with me is Mimi Sheraton, the inimitable Mimi Sheraton, who was a longtime restaurant critic for the New York Times and for many other publications, and also a very well-respected food writer in many regards, and author. And Mimi, we were talking about, restaurant reviewing started out only reviewing fine dining, and fine dining meant fancy French restaurants. But then things changed. As you said, life is changing. And that would be an introduction of so many different international cuisines. How has that affected the restaurant business and reviewing?
Well, it's affected reviewing in that one has to become somewhat familiar with the new cuisines that come to town. I was very fortunate in having traveled the world long before I became a critic at the Times, when I wrote a book called City Portraits, which took me to 60 cities all over the world. If you can't do that, if you can't taste a cuisine on its native ground, at least you study the books about it, you get an idea of what it's supposed to be. Not that authenticity is the only criterion. I don't care. I think Calvin Trillin has said, and I don't care what you call it as long as it tastes good. And ultimately, I ascribe to that. But you should have some idea of what the flavors are and what the style of eating is. And right now, we are happily deluged with cuisines from all over the world. Southeast Asian of all kinds is very, very big, whether in pure form or in fusion. And the other one coming up just all over the place is sort of North African, Middle Eastern, Israeli. Mm-hmm. We have here in New York Memme, which is close to me, a wonderful Israeli North African. And then Dizengoff and Miznon and those restaurants in the Chelsea Market. And, I mean, they're just, Noor is a very interesting, yeah. that yeah. belongs to the Bread's Bakery people. And they do a lot of Israeli cooking. There's a richness about it that appeals to people right now. The Southeast Asian, I think, has a great appeal to people who like sort of lightness, sort of greenery and delicate flavors. Not that some of it isn't very, very hot. But it's quite wonderful. In 1960, when I took the trip around the world for the book and went to Thailand, among other places, there was no Thai restaurant in New York. I had no idea what it was. It all tasted like soap and citronella to me because of lemongrass and thing. I thought, what is this food?
And now every city in the country has
and after about 2 weeks and talking to a lot of people there and going to a little cooking class there, I began to understand it. But it was, you know, totally from left field. And now, you know, we have Hanoi House, which is wonderful, and so many that do Vietnamese. And I went to Hanoi in 2009 with the New York Philharmonic because Alan Gilbert, who was then the music director, had become a friend because of an association I had with fundraising dinners at the Philharmonic. And he told me when he was in Hanoi with them playing, he was going to eat pho all over the place. And I said, if I can get an assignment, can I come and write about it? And Smithsonian bought it, and I went to Hanoi, and we ate street food with all the Philharmonic kids, you know, who mm-hmm. ran. It was just a wonderful way to suddenly get a blasting education on pho. So,
and now, look, I mean, immigrants all over
right.
the country
right.
you know, are enriching our lives as far as the
I hope they can stay here.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't go to a city that doesn't have a Thai restaurant.
That's
for sure.
Right.
If
right.
not, you know, pho and all Jap these other
sushi.
Things.
If yeah. anyone had asked me, or anyone had suggested to me in 75 or 76 that Americans would really take to eating raw fish, I would have told them they were crazy.
Hmm. And look at us now.
Look at us now.
You've seen so many different, well, these are the new trends that are coming, but in the past, there's always been a fad in dining and restaurant eating. And are there any particular fads that you remember that you were so happy they faded away?
Well, there were health fads. There were health gurus like Carlton Fredericks and just went out of my mind, the woman who was so famous. It'll come back yeah. to me when I think of something else. And we did everything they said for a while, but there were strange things then. It wasn't so much restaurants, but you had to eat blackstrap molasses and you had to have yogurt and you had to take brewer's yeast and there
brown
were
rice
brown rice and there were health food restaurants in New York. I used to go to one near the Hearst building because then I worked for Good Housekeeping. It was called Vim and Vigor, and they used to have these hot plates of food with baked squash and kale and spinach, and the whole place would smell of it. And some of the food was so caloric. They had a strawberry pureed sour cream that they put on everything. Must have had 1,000 calories. Then we would come back. We went to a health food restaurant. And now, of course, you have, in addition to health, you have the sense of responsibility of trying to sustain certain species and certain crops. We want fair trade. If their workers abroad, that they get a decent living. We want it as fresh as possible from a local market. We want it organic, though nobody really knows what that means. So, and this is very difficult for a critic. I decided once I became a critic, I could not write on those matters. Because if I really believed in those things, it would be incumbent upon me to judge a restaurant partly on their compliance with those concerns, and I didn't think that was fair.
And then you'd be eliminating so many other restaurants.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if the spinach was good, the spinach was good, and I shouldn't say, well, where did you get it? Well, now I don't like it. I just, that's not what those places were about, and so they should not be judged by that.
Yeah, I can see the difficulty in that. Definitely creates a challenge.
Yeah, right? I don't think many critics now fault a restaurant for not being that if everything is good, although they do celebrate it if they know everything came locally.
Right. So make that be one of the attractions in the special part.
Right.
Yeah. What about you have a little bit of a gripe with some of the hot new contemporary menus?
Yeah, I've been noticing lately as some of the new places get highly touted that they all have these made-up dishes that don't come from any background, as far as I can tell, except what is hot now and what will sell. And in the end, they are all sort of alike, plates with little dibs and dabs of food all over them, or salad bowls full of kale, which, by the way, I hate. And I wrote my first column for the Daily Beast was about hating kale. But they have to have the buzzwords. It has to say kale. It has to say quinoa. It has to have, I don't know what all the other things are at the moment, but it's, you can just spot it on the menus. I agree, for the sake of business, they have to have something for vegetarians and vegans, because you get a party of three or four people and one person may be a nut.
Okay, we won't go there.
I just went there.
Yeah.
You know, paleo, whatever you call it, paleo.
Right.
I have a feeling they ate people. So I don't think we want to go all the way.
So you feel you want something that's based on some sort of consistent framework.
Some sort. Right? It doesn't have to be ethnic. You know, there can be something in the chef's background. But I must say, I've done some work recently for the Major Food Group, who have a number of currently very hot restaurants in New York, Italian, French, took over the space from the Four Seasons. And they begin from a framework of whether it's Italian or whether it's New York. And when I worked for Restaurant Associates and the famous Joe Baum, creating the Four Seasons, and I worked on other restaurants for him, he wanted a book and a plan behind him. So he had a consistency, a kind of self-given authority to do what he was doing. But it made for a much more original and coordinated menu. And right now, all the menus, not all, but many, many, are, you could be in one restaurant or another, and nothing is memorable and everything is okay.
Mm, interesting. Mm-hmm. I think it's very interesting, too, that you sort of have come full circle, that you helped consult on the menu for the original Four Seasons, and here you are back again.
Yes,
you know, consulting on the Four Seasons in their new iteration.
There's no room in New York that has more memories for me than the Bar and Grill was the Four Seasons. I've seen it with BX cable and concrete blocks, and you know, grow to be that very beautiful space, which fortunately it still is because it's landmarked, and they can't change anything attached to the walls. So.
Do you have any, just as we kind of wind up here, any best experiences, worst experiences, anything that you're sad to? I do recall an article you wrote, something that you regret to see some things fading away and going away, in your vast experience of restaurant reviewing. Anything interesting that would come up as a story?
Well, there are particular types of restaurants that have gone away that I regret. And I would say the old New York seafood house, fish and seafood restaurants that would have every kind of fish done every kind of way, but they were serious about fish. The Oyster Bar in Grand Central is a little that way. Aqua Grill is a little that way. At a much higher, more innovative way, the pool at was the Four Seasons, is that, but nothing like Gloucester House, Seafair of the Aegean, and these great places where you could go in and have any, but a really fish, done for fish, not for gussying it up.
Do you think as we talked about a couple times, that the fine dining, be they French or whatever, those fine dining establishments, and they were primarily French, that were major establishments, and I think every city around the country replicated them. Do you think that they are dying out? Do you think there's a life for them?
Yes, I think there's a life for them, and I think some of the new ones are that. I mean, Le Coucou has beautiful linens and a beautiful room, and the fact that the waiter doesn't have a Swiss accent and doesn't bow to you. I mean, there is a new kind of etiquette, a little more egalitarian, which, as long as it's polite and practical, is very much to be desired. But, you know, Le Bernardin is very elegant, Le Grenouille, Majorelle, Charles Masson's new restaurant in the Lowell Hotel, very, very elegant. So there is a place for it. What is a little disconcerting to me, and I suppose it's unavoidable, is that very few places can afford to have a dress code. And so you go in, you know, if I'm going to a really nice restaurant, I put on something kind of nice, and then you sit next to somebody in shirt sleeves, you know, and it was very rampant in the Grill last night when I had dinner. I mean, some people just look like the Iceman used to look back in Brooklyn when he delivered your cake, you know, an old rag, and they can't afford to. Some do ask for a jacket. I think Grenouille, Majorelle probably ask for jackets. I don't know about ties and so on. But they can't afford to eliminate a whole group. It's too competitive. The expenses are too high. And very few are willing to do that, although they used to be very strict. They used to hand you a jacket or hand you a man a tie at a place comparable to Grenouille. I don't know if 21 demands a jacket anymore of men, and if they do at lunch. Or I was there recently, but I think everybody had a jacket on. You know, they reopened after being closed for plumbing disasters for a long, long time. So it was nice to be back there. That's a room of memories, you know. I love some of the old-time rooms. It's very nice.
When you want a real special dinner, there's nothing quite like you know, all that fanciness. And tablecloths. Tell me, what's your opinion of the disappearance of white tablecloths?
Well, there are plenty of places that still have them, but in some places it's very practical not to have them.
Well, cost efficient.
Seafood restaurants almost never did. Yeah. They usually had scrubbed oak tops. That was, you know, because it's slobbery and smelly, so you have to clean it up all the time.
Or brown paper.
yeah. But it's the laundry bill.
Sure.
And some of them have sheets of paper over tablecloths so they can change it. I don't care what they do as long as it's right for the place. I don't think if it doesn't have tablecloths, I'm not going to go. Mm-hmm. Let's see what they have. Maybe it's very attractive. Maybe it's very comfortable. However, not having tablecloths and not having carpet brings up the problem of noise,
absolutely,
which is unbearable. And as far as I can tell, is not going any place soon because the younger group does not mind. And the restaurateurs basically don't care what older people think. It's that simple. They all say to me, the only people who complain are over 50. so the hell with it.
Right. Well, then speaking of the new wave and the younger people, do you have any warnings for them, any caveats about some of these online quickie review sites?
I'm not a fan of any consumer reviews, including Zagat. I think you can never be sure whose opinion it is. I don't know of any, and maybe there are some, and I'll apologize. I don't know of any who demand proof that the voter was actually in the restaurant, including Zagat, unless they've changed a lot in recent years. So very often, most often, the consumer reviews follow the pattern of the local reviewer. If the New York Times gives it 4 stars, then people go out expecting it to be good. There are some surprises. There are some inconsistencies. But I think they're worthless. You don't know if the restaurateur has managed to gather a group of people who are all going to write in and say it's good. And who cares about their opinion? My feeling is that Sagat, less so now than it used to be, was very handy for knowing what was in an area. If you were going to the theater district, and for addresses and phone numbers. The new typographic format is much harder to read. But that would be, to me, the only use. And when I go to a city that I don't know anything about, if there is such a city, I go online and try to get reviews of the local newspaper critics to see what they've said recently. And now that's blissfully easy to do. I mean, you can find out what the Chicago critics think of the Chicago restaurants.
So, and you had said, well, Craig Claiborne sort of established that, you know, you have to go to a restaurant at least 3 times. You think most of the newspaper
I don't think
restaurants?
So. I don't know, and I can't say for sure, but I don't think there are many, if any, that require 3. And I've won as many as 10 times sometimes. I reviewed a restaurant. I had been 4 or 5 times, and the newspaper went on strike for 3 months. So when I came back, I felt I can't use a 3-month-old review. That restaurant developed back I went. And I'm sure Pete Wells does that. You know, you go until you're satisfied. And I never had a complaint about an expense. And my last year there, my expenses were about $90,000. I can't even imagine what they are now.
Okay.
That was just for New York reviewing. Not if I went to France or Italy or someplace like that for the paper. That was a separate thing. So it must be at least 4 times that now. Well, I remember when we were doing the menu for the original Four Seasons, and Joe Baum was pricing drinks, and he said, let's see if we can get a buck for a martini. So, 1958.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. Now, let's see if we can get
$20
for
it. Right. That's absolutely right. Well, it's such a pleasure to talk to you, and your stories are and experience just speak volumes, and I think every restaurateur should heed whatever they
well
whatever
they gave me a hear. Wonderful life, I will say that.
And you were quite a formidable writer and reviewer, I have to say that. You
thank
were
you.
And very studied and very fair,
opinionated.
Opinionated, of
you
course, but
better
that's,
believe it.
That's what they paid you for. Well, it's been a real pleasure, and I hope that you will come back and join me again. We'll talk about another line of restaurant
anytime,
business.
Anytime, Linda. Okay. I've enjoyed it very much.
And
thank
thanks.
You.
That's Mimi Sheraton. And don't forget to buy her book, A Thousand Foods to Eat Before
You Die, all over the world. It's
at Workman
a travel
Press?
And food. Workman Press, yes.
Okay, so it's International Foods. A Thousand Foods to Eat Before You Die. And you'll learn something new on every page.
I did in writing.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, and again, this has been A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.